Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Adjuvant systemic therapy of early breast cancer was considered standard of care in 1979, and data supporting the benefits of treatment in colon cancer has been available since the late 1980s. But in lung cancer, it's only been in the last 3 years that convincing randomized trial data have supported this strategy. I met with Dr. Corey Langer to get his take on adjuvant therapy of non-small cell lung cancer and other research-to-practice issues, and he began our conversation by commenting on two recent data sets with important clinical implications.
I think we have sort of a solidification of our understanding of the adjuvant setting. Probably two of the more important studies that were presented were an update of the CLGB study, an elderly analysis of BR10. In addition, there was an analysis of all of the recent platinum-containing adjuvant trials, both positive and negative. The biggest disappointment was the CLGB trial.
Can you kind of go back through what the design of the study was and sort of the history, what's happened with it?
Well, it was a unique trial. It was the only trial to evaluate paclitaxel and carboplatin combination in the adjuvant setting. It also was the only trial to focus specifically on stage 1B.
Why did they do that, incidentally?
Not completely clear. I think the feeling was CLGB, at the time it initiated the trial, had a competing trial for 3A. I'm not sure what they had for stage 2, but they certainly had a competing trial for 3A. Where they were giving adjuvant chemotherapy to everybody and then randomizing patients to either radiation or observation. Unfortunately, that trial was halted because of poor accrual. It had maybe 60 or 70 patients. I understand it's going to be reported soon, but I don't know the results. It's a very important trial. That's an unanswered question. We still don't know in the resected setting whether radiation does in fact have a role in Hyler N1 and, for that matter, resected R0, 3A, N2 disease. The port analysis would suggest there's a detrimental effect, but there was an interesting retrospective sub-analysis presented last year at the World Lung Meeting in Barcelona that looked at the ANITA trial. And again, this is a modern third-generation chemotherapy trial, vinorelbine cisplatin, all comers, stage 1, 2, and 3A. And in the 3A group, those who got chemo as well as radiation seemed to do better than those who got chemotherapy alone. So hypothesis generating, certainly rather small numbers, but would suggest perhaps that the port analysis, which included data from the 60s and 70s and 80s, is really archaic, and that we have to reassess this whole issue. It's a controversial question, and there are no recent studies and, frankly, no ongoing studies that will settle the issue. But going back to the CLGB trial, this was an adjuvant trial, stage 1B only, so very tightly defined group, looking specifically at patients without nodal involvement, but tumors that were at least 3 centimeters or had invasion of the mainstem bronchus or the visceral pleura. Took 7 years to accrue fewer than 400 patients. And I think that really says something about the American population, and certainly about American clinicians and patients. It is very tough to do an observation or best supportive care control trial. It's just the American mindset does not grapple with that concept easily. But nevertheless, the initial report 2 years ago suggested, actually, this flat out showed a statistically significant improvement. The p-value was in the order of 0.028. There was about a 12% improvement in 4-year survival, 59% for the control arm, 71% for the intervention arm. And treatment delivery was fairly good. The majority of patients were actually able to get all 4 cycles in at or near full dose. And this year, there was an update. It was tremendously disappointing. The p-value had risen to 0.1. The 5-year survival difference was on the order of 2 to 3%. Now, there's a number of criticisms. They still have not observed enough events or the predetermined number of events. So this may, in fact, be the second premature reporting of a critical phase 3 trial. The other interesting caveat, again, it's a retrospective analysis, but those whose tumors were 4 centimeters or larger actually did have a survival benefit. So results here have left us in a therapeutic quandary. What do we do with stage 1B patients? Do we treat them? Do we observe them? Do we replicate that trial in this group? Do we segregate them by size using 4 centimeters as our cutoff? And if we do treat them, do we use paclitaxel and carboplatin? Or do we dial in a cisplatin-containing regimen?
I mean, does it seem like it'd be more likely the regimen or the lack of events that's the explanation?
I think it has very little to do with the regimen. If you go back to the other trials that included cisplatin, the IALT, the BR10, and for that matter, the ANITA trial, all of them included stage 1B. In subset analyses, none of those trials showed a survival benefit. Now, granted, these are small in numbers. They may not have been powered sufficiently in that group. But frankly, the best survival separation we've seen in stage 1B is with paclitaxel and carboplatin, not with the cisplatin-containing regimen. So people have looked at these data and have dismissed the role of carboplatin in hand. Frankly, I don't think we have sufficient data. There's only one trial that looked at carboplatin in the adjuvant setting. It was 1B only. Carboplatin was not evaluated in stage 2 or stage 3A. The vast majority of clinicians, at least in the United States, continue to use carboplatin, at least in advanced disease, and there's a comfort factor that exists that they would tend to use the same regimen in earlier stage. But I've noticed both amongst my colleagues and also in the community that a sizable percentage of folks are using cisplatin-based regimens. And frankly, I have to confess, since ASCO, at least for stage 2 and 3A, I've started using cisplatin. 4 centimeters or larger, stage 1B, I'm still using paclitaxel and carboplatin.
Do you think that this is basically an events thing? If you compare the number of events in the other trials that are positive to the number of deaths essentially in this trial, would you come up with that conclusion, or does it seem like it's something? I mean, that seems like the obvious thing. I don't know.
It could very well be. In fact, if you look at the percentage of recurrences and deaths in the control arm versus the intervention arm, there's still a 9 or 10% difference. So it may just be that the curves narrowed a bit at 5 years. They may separate again for all we know.
Well, that's the other thing, is the fact that the recurrence-free survival still is.
Oh, it's far better. And, about 30 months better.
You know, you've got in colon cancer, FOLFOX is a standard of care. There's absolutely no demonstration of survival there. They're doing it based on disease-free survival. Aromatase inhibitors in breast cancer really don't have survival at this
point. For that
matter,
adjuvant chemotherapy in breast cancer, the disease-free survival usually, not always, but usually presages the survival benefit.
So why is everybody getting so bent out of shape?
Not completely clear.
Well, you change your practice.
But for stage 2 and 3A, where I really don't have any carbo data, for 1B, I'm still using paclitaxel and carboplatin. I have to say that probably the majority of my colleagues are using cisplatin in that setting. It's not completely clear. I think in clinical investigators, we worship at the altar of the p-value. There is something mystical about 0.05, and the minute something skirts above it, I challenge a statistician to tell me that there's a major difference between 0.051 and 0.049, and yet one's significant and one's not.
Again, also, if you look back, you know, breast cancer in the late 80s, we had this issue of no negative tumors. We couldn't show it, and eventually we did show it. Colon cancer, same, still huge debate about stage 2 disease.
I think that's an analogous situation. The non-node-involved tumors are harder to show a survival benefit.
What about the issue? You mentioned there was a platinum meta-analysis.
Yeah, it was very interesting. It was called LACE, which stands for Lung Adjuvant Cisplatin Evaluation. And it looked at the 3 positive platinum trials, ANITA, BR10, and the IL trial, as well as 2 other trials, the ALPI trial from Italy and the BLT trial, primarily from the UK, which were negative. So in fairness, it looked at both positive and negative trials. In an aggregate, despite the inclusion of the negative trials, there was a robust, statistically significant improvement in survival with platinum-based regimens. Overall, about a 5% difference, 5.5% difference at 5 years. I would argue that's statistically significant and clinically meaningful. And in their further analysis, that benefit was essentially confined to stage 2 and 3A. When they looked at 1A, in fact, chemotherapy seemed to be associated with detrimental outcome. In 1B, it wasn't significant. It was trending in the right direction, but the p-value wasn't there, and the confidence intervals clearly overlapped unity. The best regimens seemed to include vinorelbine, but those regimens that included vinorelbine also include higher doses of cisplatin. So is it the third-generation partner agent, or is it the dose of platinum?
You mentioned the Canadian study reporting on the elderly. Can you talk about that?
Yes. It's one of the first analyses of outcome in the elderly in the adjuvant setting. The investigators who brought us the ANITA trial are currently conducting an analysis, but their data are not yet uniformly available. But the BR10 trial, the sub-analysis, was presented by Carmela Pepe at ASCO during the lung plenary session. And they used 65 as their cutoff. It's somewhat arbitrary. How we define elderly is open to debate. Is it 65? Is it 70? Is it really 75? Certainly, most of us define it as at least 10 or 15 years older than we are. But in their analysis, those who were over 65 actually constituted about a third of the accrual to BR10. So it was a fairly large group. And I suspect that was the reason they chose 65. It would have been a much smaller percentage, obviously, if it had been 70. Amongst the elderly, a higher percentage with squamous histology, which is probably no surprise because probably the nature of the cigarettes, many of these folks had smoked when they were in their teens, 20s, and 30s, they were unfiltered. Clearly a higher proportion of men who are more likely to have squamous histology. Intriguingly, the elderly had a lower percentage of PS0 patients. I would have thought by the very nature of the study by selection alone, they would have preferentially picked relatively more fit elderly patients, but they didn't. The upshot, the elderly had a survival benefit. The younger patients did better across the board, but relatively speaking, comparing chemo to observation, there was still a survival benefit. And that benefit was on the order of 12% or so, 12% absolute difference in survival. The one group that did not seem to benefit, in fact, had terrible outcome regardless, were patients 75 years of age or older. And that was a very small percentage overall. It was about, I would guess, about 5 or 6% of the overall population. And their five-year survival was in the order of 25 to 30%, whereas the rest of the group had a five-year survival in excess of 60%.
How much of that was non-cancer mortality?
Intriguing. The elderly are about fourfold more likely to have non-cancer cause of death. Under 65, non-cancer death rate in that study was maybe 4.5%, 5% for the elderly, and here it was defined to 65 or older. It was on the order of about 16 or 17%. So they're competing causes of death, competing comorbidity. Folks over 65 who've undergone resection and have smoked are probably at relatively higher risk for heart disease, for emphysema.
What about toxicity from chemotherapy and delivery of chemotherapy?
It was impaired. The elderly were less likely to complete chemotherapy. They were more likely to bail out either because of toxicity or for other concerns. Their overall dose intensity was less. The toxicities overall, when you look at it just generally, weren't that much worse. They actually had less myalgias, probably because they got less vinorelbine in that study. But they also had no increased incidence of myelosuppression or neutropenic fever, which frankly I was surprised by. But this may be more a token of the treatment delivery rather than true increased risk.
What was your overall take from this presentation, and how did it compare to your own clinical experience?
The fit elderly are capable of receiving adjuvant therapy. The fit elderly will benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy. People often argue if they're 70 or 72, they don't have that many years left. That's not true. If you look at actuarial tables, otherwise healthy 70-year-old probably has 15 to 18 years on average left. We're talking about a meaningful chunk of their existence. So to deny a fit elderly patient the opportunity at least to get adjuvant chemotherapy is really not founded by the data.
How do you approach selection of regimen in the elderly as opposed to younger patients?
Well, that's a big dilemma. Elderly are more likely to be deaf. They're more likely to have renal impairment. They're more likely to have comorbidities, which is going to make the obligatory fluid load we give with cisplatin a lot tougher. So frankly, frequently in the elderly, I will use carboplatin. I'll use that again in stage 2 and 3A. The rules I mentioned earlier about tending to use cisplatin again probably applied a lot more systematically to younger patients, certainly those in their 50s and to probably at least those up to 65. But if a patient has hearing compromise, you're not going to give them cisplatin.
Where are things heading in terms of the next generation of adjuvant trials and specifically the issue of bevacizumab, and how is that impacted by the CALGB study?
The upcoming trial is going to compare chemo alone, and I call it chemo du jour because there is literally a choice of regimens, versus chemo plus bevacizumab. So patients will receive 4 cycles of chemo, either alone or with bevacizumab, grafted onto the chemo and then continued for a full year, bevacizumab alone. The research community has taken the CALGB data to heart, and the carboplatin regimen has been struck.
What are your thoughts in terms of what you think the safety will be of bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting? And can you also comment on some of the data that's come out further defining thoracic hemorrhage and other issues with bevacizumab?
Well, the 4599 remains a landmark trial. It's the first phase 3 to show a survival advantage in treatment-naive advanced disease for any sort of targeted agent. For the first time in the cooperative group setting, we've pierced the one-year barrier, median survival that exceeds a year, two-year survival that exceeds 20%. We've never seen that in cooperative group trials and certainly not in phase 3 trials. The big problem, of course, for ECOG 4599 with the restrictive eligibility criteria, patients with brain metastasis were excluded, those with squamous histology, those with any sort of antecedent hemoptysis, those requiring ongoing therapeutic anticoagulation. Low-dose Coumadin was allowed, but higher systemic doses, those with any sort of clotting diathesis. We actually did a retrospective analysis of our patient population at Fox Chase and reported this a couple years ago at ASCO, and at least half of the patient population would ordinarily be candidates for a typical upfront chemo-naive phase 3 trial could not have gone on to ECOG 4599.
And what were the key factors, the main factors that made?
It was the whole mix, probably 20% squamous histology, 15 to 20% brain metastasis, performance status issues. A fairly sizable percentage of patients have clotting diathesis. It's not uncommon. It's common in solid tumors in general. It's particularly common in epithelial malignancies. So the adjuvant trial, the big problem, of course, in the initial randomized phase 2 was bleeding, and that was observed primarily in squamous cell patients, hence the exclusion of squamous patients from the phase 3. At ASCO, they did an updated analysis of pulmonary hemorrhage in the setting of ECOG 4599. Just to give you some background, there was roughly a 2% incidence of fatal pulmonary hemorrhages, fatal hemorrhages that may or may not have included bleeding from the lungs. They tried to identify some peculiar uniform factor that would predict for hemorrhage. Basically, they couldn't come up with it. Number one, the numbers are very small. That the only correlation that existed were patients who had pre-existing central cavitating lesions. A lot of this is going to be moot in the adjuvant setting. By definition, there's going to be no in situ cancer in the chest. They'll have been resected. Presumably, they'll have R0 resections. By definition, none of these patients will have brain metastasis. I can guarantee you're going to have to screen these patients with a brain scan, preferably a brain MRI. In some of the older studies, that wasn't typically or uniformly done, but I think in anybody who gets bevacizumab, it's mandatory. So those two factors are no longer operative. The issue of therapeutic anticoagulation, I think, is still in play, but I doubt that would significantly limit the accrual to the study. My big concern about the upcoming phase 3 is the mandatory use of cisplatin, automatically excluding probably 40 to 50% of the population that we would otherwise have included in phase 3. And, you know, who knows? We may start the study, see that accrual is lagging, and then opt to amend it and include carboplatin again. Or we may find that accrual's just fine. There'll be sufficient numbers of patients out there who are getting cisplatin-based regimens. And this is an easier trial to do, at least conceptually, because everybody's getting chemotherapy. We're not comparing chemotherapy to best supportive care. So that aspect of this trial is less contentious. The only variable, of course, is whether they get bevacizumab.
I mean, it seems like it would be rational not just to improve accrual. It seems like it would make sense to look at carbo and paclitaxel. I mean, that was the regimen that was combined with bevacizumab.
Which is an important point because, frankly, bevacizumab, at least in the initial phase 3, the positive phase 3, was not combined with gemcitabine and cisplatin. It was not combined with vinorelbine and cisplatin. It was not combined with docetaxel and cisplatin. There is an ongoing European trial that's looking at gem and cisplatin plus or minus bevacizumab. I imagine that may be reported in the next 6 to 12 months. So it's a companion trial to the ECOG 4599. But we really have a paucity of data, particularly safety data. And that's a concern with gem cisplatin. Patients' platelets drop. So here we have a drug that has a propensity toward bleeding. We're giving them chemotherapy that may, at least theoretically, increase their risk of bleeding.
Any concerns about using docetaxel-based regimens with Bev?
I probably have the least concern with that regimen because historically, at least, docetaxel in combination with either cisplatin or carboplatin is not particularly tough on platelets.
You want to give me a prediction, assuming the trial gets done, what it's going to show?
I'm an optimist.
the success of bevacizumab really seems to be extending across multiple solid tumors, unrelated solid tumors. So here we have colorectal that's shown a survival advantage. We have at least a hint, maybe not quite as solid as colorectal, but a hint of an advantage in breast cancer. And I think fairly solid data for lung cancer, at least in the context of ECOG 4599. It'll be interesting to see if the CIS-GEM study is positive. But that study is positive. I have very little doubt, potentially, that the bevacizumab will be beneficial. On the other hand, given all the risk factors, I have total equipoise about conducting the trial.
Well, probably before the lung trial is like halfway accrued, we should have data from the NSABP colon trial, which actually closed today, I just found out, 2,700 patients in 2 years. So, you know,
we should do so well in lung
right.
cancer. Forget the accrual target offhand. It's going to be a big trial, but it's not going to be that big.
You guys need to get the NSABP involved. I keep thinking that, but I know that'll never
happen.
They
don't happen. Do lung.
Well, get them to do lung. Younger patient, good health, has the financial means to pay for it, high risk stage 2 situation, says, I'll pay for the bevacizumab if you think it'll help me. Would you treat the patient off study?
I would send them to somebody else.
You would not be comfortable treating a patient?
I say this is a study question. There are real risk issues here. The study itself is looking at 12 months of therapy. We don't really know whether that's the optimal duration. Maybe we can get by just with 4 cycles. That'll be a subsequent question only if the study is positive. But off study, I will not treat them. I'll give them chemotherapy and that's it.
What's your clinical experience been since 4599 came out in your own practice in terms of using bevacizumab? What are you seeing?
We're starting to use it. It does have compendium listing, so we are getting reimbursed for it. Although on occasion, I've had to write appeal letters. I think some of the insurance companies like to wear us down. But particularly if you cite the data, and the data, as far as I'm concerned, are unimpeachable, it's very hard for them to avoid covering it. Not all patients are embracing it. If you're upfront, you tell them about pulmonary hemorrhage. You have to tell them that there's a 2% or so fatal hemorrhage rate. That's a showstopper. Patients don't like that. Even in the context of having a uniformly fatal disease.
Yeah, it's strange.
That is very scary.
I understand it, but it is a little bit.
And several patients who refused it on that basis, and other patients, ironically, have asked for it, but because of some peculiar characteristic, they had brain metastasis or they had mixed adenosquamous histology, they're really not candidates for it. I wouldn't feel comfortable giving it. My practice, of course, is skewed somewhat in that we have a number of ongoing phase 1 and phase 2s. So I still have comfort taking a patient who would be bevacizumab eligible and giving them a chemo combination with some other targeted agent. We're looking at a number of the oral angiogenesis inhibitors. We've also started looking at a Pfizer compound, insulin growth factor receptor inhibitor. So it's almost like a tsunami of targeted agents that are arriving weekly in the clinic.
Any experience with Zactima or?
No personal experience. It's an interesting drug. It belongs to this new family of dual or multi-kinase inhibitors. So here's a drug that has both anti-angiogenesis activity as well as EGFR inhibitory effect. It's not clear at which dose, what percentage of each effect is operative, and I think that's still open to debate. There was an interesting randomized phase 2 presented by John Hammock at ASCO this year in the second line setting that looked at docetaxel either alone or combined with 2 different doses of ZD6474 as Zactima. And progression-free survival was improved, particularly for the lower dose arm, which is intriguing. The control group got a placebo, so presumably the people didn't really know what they were getting, although this drug is very similar to the other EGFR inhibitors. Patients are still getting rash, they're still getting diarrhea, and they're getting toxicities that are probably peculiar to angiogenesis inhibition. We're seeing headaches, hypertension. Don't typically see that with the EGFR inhibitors.
I guess that's the VEGF part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Getting back to bevacizumab in your own practice, have you treated enough patients to have any kind of feel as to whether or not the responses are better?
It's my bias that they are, but I'm probably being very selective about the patients I'm giving it to. I'm typically giving it in conjunction with a paclitaxel carbo regimen, either the same regimen that was used in ECOG 4599. Remember, this is 200 per meter squared taxol, not 175 and not 225. Carbo at AUC6. I had quite a lot of experience actually on the trial. We accrued about 20 patients to the trial. Plus, we were involved in the initial randomized phase 2, so my comfort level with this drug has increased. increased quite a bit over the last few years. I have to confess, in selected patients, in selected circumstances, I have also started using this in combination with erlotinib alone,
a double-targeted agent. I want to ask you about that, but before I do, would you or have you treated patients with treated brain mets?
Yes.
What specifically, you know, are you looking for in order to make yourself feel comfortable?
That they're neurologically intact, good performance status, that the brain mets at very least are stable or improved, that there's no evidence of vasogenic edema or midline shift, and that the patients know full well that we are sort of going at least to some extent out on a limb. And there is, in fact, an ongoing trial that is looking at bevacizumab in combination with either chemo up front, patients who've never had chemotherapy before but have had brain mets that are treated, or in the second line setting. Again, treated brain metastasis. They're not giving this to patients who have not had therapy for brain metastasis. The brain metastasis issue is less concerning to me than the histology issue. That is really based primarily on fear. There were some early studies, not in lung cancer, I believe in sarcoma. I may be wrong. It may have been renal cell, but it was certainly not a typical lung cancer or colorectal cancer population where they did observe bleeding. And that gave the investigators pause and really resulted in this sort of blanket exclusion. And I think in retrospect, that may have been a bit draconian. But I suspect the ongoing phase 2 safety study will show that the brain metastasis are safe. I'm a little more concerned about squamous histology. You go back to the randomized phase 2, 4 out of 13 confirmed squamous patients had pulmonary hemorrhage. That's a huge percentage.
A lot of people think that these hemorrhages are somehow tied into response. Is that your take?
That's my take, too. Anecdotally, I had a patient on the original 4599. She didn't have squamous cell, but she had NOS, not otherwise specified. So this unfortunate woman presented with the central tumor, fairly large, shortness of breath and wheezing. She had metastatic disease that was adrenal metastasis. In fact, that's how her diagnosis was made. And she elected to go on the study. She was randomized to the bevacizumab arm. There was no sham IV placebo. We knew exactly what people were getting. And 2 weeks into treatment, she developed fever. The initial thought was that she might have neutropenic fever. She was admitted to the hospital. Her counts were fine. She was ultimately diagnosed with bronchitis and given antibiotics, quickly defervesced, and was discharged. And her last words were, "This is the best I have felt in 6 months."
Wow.
She then, while washing up at the sink just before she was due to leave the hospital, she started to cough and she started to spit up blood, and it became basically a deluge of blood. She exsanguinated into the sink and she coated and died within a half hour.
You had a postmortem?
Yes.
What did it show?
The entire tumor, the primary tumor, which measured 7 to 8 centimeters, was almost completely devitalized. There were very few remnant viable cells in a 2-week period. I kept asking the pathologist, where is the bronchoarterial fistula? There's got to be some sort of connection here. It's a central tumor. They really didn't see it. It was just a sort of total meltdown of the connective tissue matrix that kept this tumor together. And ironically, her adrenal didn't really evidence that much of a response.
But
the primary tumor had shrunk, had sort of disintegrated. And some of the structural integrity of the tumor was so disrupted that the bleeding ensued. And it's ironic. I think a fair number of these hemorrhages are really evidence that the drug is working almost too quickly.
But it's interesting. You're saying you didn't see that in the adrenal. Did she have other areas of metastasis?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Only areas of involvement were the lung and the adrenal. Now, granted, it's only 2 weeks into treatment. Who knows, over time we might have seen something. So that experience certainly was a showstopper for me. A number of my colleagues were somewhat diffident about putting folks on that trial after hearing that event. But you know what? You go back into the literature predating the targeted therapy era, and you'll find people who have hemorrhaged out. My original study of paclitaxel and carboplatin, first cycle, week 3, I had a very similar patient.
What was the most recent chest x-ray or CAT scan that she'd had? Was it at pre-treatment, or she had one at 2 weeks when
no,
she...
No, she had a chest x-ray, but her baseline pre-treatment scan was a CAT scan.
Because there's been this thought, and I think there were some data at ASCO, you know, about cavitary lesions.
That was maybe the one upshot of the 4599 retrospective analysis. Those who had baseline cavitary lesions seemed to be at higher risk. She did not have a cavitary lesion.
So are they going to allow squamous patients in the adjuvant trial?
Yes, because those patients will have been resected.
Yeah. And I mean,
so
you would expect
existing tumor.
So if your theory is right and other people's theories are right, maybe those patients will do better.
I think so.
Interesting. What about location? This woman had a central tumor. Where are we with that?
Primarily central. If you go back to the original 4599 and also the original randomized phase 2, patients who had more central tumors seemed to be more prone.
I thought that really wasn't coming through.
In 4599, I believe it still was. But again, the numbers are still relatively small. There were well over 800 patients accrued. There were 9 serious hemorrhages.
You mentioned erlotinib and bevacizumab. Can you provide an update of what we know about that from clinical research and what you've seen in your own practice?
Well, there's an interesting trial that looked at chemo alone, chemo plus bevacizumab, and then erlotinib and bevacizumab. This, again, was a randomized phase 2 presented during one of the poster discussions, I believe, or one of the mini symposia at ASCO. And the targeted therapy combination seemed to do just as well as chemo plus bevacizumab and actually had fewer adverse events as you'd expect. It didn't have the chemotherapy toxicity. It had different constellation of side effects, but not cytopenia, neuropathy, or hair loss. My practice at this point is almost purely anecdotal. I have perhaps 2 or 3 patients that are on that combination. I would prefer to do it on a study, ideally, but these are patients who particularly lend themselves to that. Both are non-smokers. Both are relatively young. Both are quite intelligent and are, frankly, fairly familiar with the phase 2 data. In this era, patients and their families Google their disease, and they get amazing amounts of data about their diagnosis and about therapy.
So now, in these 2 non-smokers, have they had prior therapy, or is this the first therapy they're getting?
The female non-smoker had prior paclitaxel carboplatin only. So this is really a second line. The male non-smoker, and both are fairly young, has had multiple prior treatments.
And how are they doing?
Both well.
Responding or stable?
The female patient is in, frankly, much better shape. She had a transient increase in pulmonary nodules. She had multiple, almost like a firestorm of nodules in her chest, and they've shrunk. She also had a CEA elevation, for what it's worth, and that's normalized. The male patient is sort of a mixed picture. His primary lesion, if anything, has grown a bit, but his liver metastasis, adrenal metastasis, bone metastasis have all improved. In fact, ironically, I saw them both this morning.
Interesting. Speaking of non-smoking, can you kind of update us on where we are in terms of predictors of response to TKI, specifically erlotinib?
It's a very complicated picture. Certainly, clinically, the patients most likely to respond are non-smokers, women, adenocarcinoma, and East Asians. And if, in fact, you have the entire constellation, your chance of responding to EGFR TKIs is on the order of 60 to 70%. It's quite good. And survival in that group with single agent erlotinib up front is quite good, on the order of 70 to 80% in 1 year. We don't see that with chemotherapy. The molecular picture is quite a bit murkier. Of course, mutation analysis initially was thought to be the sine qua non of how to select patients, but at this point, only about 10 to 15% have the mutations. Fred Hirsch and others are looking at other potential markers, and I suspect, and again, this is just a prediction, I have no prospective data to support this, but I suspect over time it may turn out to be a combination of immunohistochemical staining and FISH. In Fred Hirsch's retrospective analysis of patients who had received gefitinib, those who were negative for both really had atrocious outcome, virtually no responses, very poor survival. If they were positive for one or the other, and particularly if they were positive on both bases, they seemed to do much better.
What are your thoughts about the so-called oligosmokers, people with less than, let's say, 10 or 15 total pack year histories in terms of response to TKIs?
It's a continuum. That's my general gestalt of the situation. We're still debating how to define a non-smoker. By convention, it's fewer than 100 cigarettes. That's not a very large part of the population. But if you look at lung cancer in general, it's still about 10 or 12%, maybe even 15%.
The 10 to 15 pack years, they're probably more like smokers and less like the non-smokers, but not as bad as the smokers. But still, that's not clear. One of the very interesting sidebars to the Tribute trial, which was paclitaxel carboplatin plus or minus erlotinib, it was a placebo-controlled trial, which was negative overall, but in the non-smoker population, there was a doubling of median survival. The non-smokers who received erlotinib with chemotherapy had a median survival of 22 months, and the group getting chemotherapy alone was on the order of 10 and a half months. And that is an observation that absolutely begs replication. The CLGB is partly doing that. They're running a randomized phase 2 looking at erlotinib alone or erlotinib in combination with chemotherapy. But ultimately, I think you need to replicate the Tribute trial in a non-smoking population. So there is at least a proposal through both the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group and the CLGB to try to do that. Probably end up being a three-arm trial. Chemo du jour with bevacizumab and those who are eligible versus chemo du jour and bevacizumab with erlotinib, and then a third arm that'll probably be either erlotinib alone or erlotinib with bevacizumab. It may be a bit complicated, but I think it'll address all the issues that come up.
That's an adjuvant or?
This is going to be advanced disease treatment-naive patients.
How do you approach non-smoking patients right now in a non-protocol setting, adjuvant, locally advanced, metastatic, first line?
Adjuvant setting, I give them the same systemic therapy I would give to a smoking population.
No erlotinib?
Not yet.
Suppose it's a female, Asian, you know, keep going down the line. Is there anything that would get you to do?
There might be things I would get Vince Miller to do. It wouldn't happen to me yet. There's several things that give me pause. You look at the Asian population, particularly the Japanese population, there's a higher risk of interstitial lung disease. And I'm not sure in the absence of a study that has clearly demonstrated survival benefit for erlotinib, I think you have to respect that toxicity. The other observation that deters me is the SWOG analysis. Remember, there was a randomized phase 3 trial in locally advanced non-small cell that looked at topoisomerase platinum radiation followed by docetaxel and then a randomization to maintenance gefitinib or placebo. And in that trial, gefitinib actually did worse. It wasn't significantly worse, but it was trending in the wrong direction. The p-value is 0.09. I will not empirically use erlotinib in either the adjuvant setting or in locally advanced non-small cell. I will only use an advanced disease, and I will use it only sparingly upfront in treatment-naive patients, even though the indication, at least at this point, is essentially second and third line.
I mean, I'm looking at myself being a non-smoker diagnosed with metastatic disease first line. Maybe I'm not that sick symptomatically. You know, it sounds pretty tempting, you know, to try.
But I would preferentially put you on the trial that compares chemo du jour, probably chemo and bevacizumab, versus that combination.
But I mean, how much do you have to lose by, you know?
Probably very little, particularly in advanced disease.
Right, that's what I'm talking about.
That's a different issue. Adjuvant, locally advanced, I think the stakes are higher.
I mean, it reminds me a little bit about hormone therapy in breast cancer that is obviously less toxic than chemotherapy. And, you know, if the patient's stable, they're going to try it out. But I don't see that happening with non-smokers and non-small cell.
But that brings up another issue. At least in the adjuvant setting in breast cancer, hormonal therapy worked best, at least in those who got chemotherapy, if it was given sequentially and not concurrently. So there's a tremendous interest actually in re-looking at integrating EGFR TKIs with chemotherapy, but not simultaneously. Look at it sequentially or intercalate the EGFR TKIs either at higher dose or discontinuous regimen. Give the chemotherapy day one and then start the EGFR TKI day two or three, continue it for 2 weeks and then have a washout period. So we'll be seeing more data certainly in the next 6 to 12 months, I think, looking at some of these regimens. In the right population that has the clinical profile that would suggest a potential benefit to erlotinib, I'd certainly consider it upfront, but only in advanced disease. I have not used it empirically in the adjuvant setting. I will only do that on a clinical trial.
You mentioned the SWOG study in locally advanced disease looking at the so-called 9504 chemotherapy regimen along with gefitinib. What about the chemotherapy backbone to that? Where are we right now with that regimen?
The Hoosier Oncology Group has actually conducted a phase 3 trial looking at etoposide platinum radiation alone or that backbone, if you will, followed by the consolidative docetaxel. I've not seen the final data. The trial apparently has completed accrual. The total accrual was fewer than 250 patients. So my fear all along has been that the trial might trend positive, but it would be underpowered. It'll be very interesting to see the final data. If it's trending in the right direction, but it's not positive, I don't think that proves or disproves the theory. The results of that phase 2 trial, 9504, is really an outlier. The median survival in the stage 3B population was over 2 years. I believe it was 26 months. The 5-year survival rate was just shy of 30%. We've never seen data like that in locally advanced disease. Remember, it was a phase 2. It was fewer than 100 patients. There were no phase 3 data. There's still no phase 3 data proving that consolidation is truly beneficial. Having said that, are we doing it? Probably the vast majority of us are giving some sort of consolidation. It may be docetaxel. It may be the same regimen that we continued during the radiation. It may be some other single agent or combination. It is usually chemo. I will not substitute targeted agent for chemotherapy in the consolidative setting.
What's your usual approach in a non-protocol setting?
Off-protocol, particularly in an older population that makes cisplatin untenable, I'll give them the Hock Choi regimen, weekly paclitaxel carboplatin with concurrent radiation, uninterrupted continuous RT to about 63 or 66 gray. And then in the consolidative setting, and here I'm a bit schizophrenic, I will sometimes continue the same regimen, although I'll up the doses basically to a systemic dose using either Q3 week or more commonly what I call the Bolani regimen, weekly paclitaxel at 80 to 100 per meter squared, days 1, 8, and 15, carboplatin at AUC 5 or 6, cycled at 4-week intervals at 3 cycles, or I will use docetaxel as it was used in the 9504. My big concern about docetaxel in that setting is myelosuppression. If I give docetaxel, I tend to pair it with pegfilgrastim. I just find it's much safer.
Where do you see the role, if any, of nab-paclitaxel in non-small cell? Is that coming?
There are phase 1 and phase 2 data. Mark Szczesny and Tom Stincombe have conducted early trials that suggest quite a bit of activity. Tony Greco and the Sarah Cannon group have looked at weekly nab-paclitaxel and carboplatin, pretty much the Bolani regimen, substituting the Abraxane drug for paclitaxel. And they've observed 1-year survival rate in excess of 50%. Now, again, is it selection or is it real? I guess cautious optimism is probably the phrase that applies here. But remember, we've been down this path before with polyglutamated paclitaxel, the Zyotax drug.
How much of an advantage do you think the shorter infusion time and lack of need for pre-medications is going to factor in non-small cell?
If everything else is a wash, it's still an advantage. You can avoid steroids. You can avoid 3 hours, cut it down to 10 or 20 minutes. I think that's very attractive both for clinicians and the patients.
So last question. In breast cancer, our group is putting together an initiative called Design a Trial. We're going to have people submit ideas. Forget the funding. Assume you have all the funding you want. What trial would you like to see get done? So I'm going to ask you the same question as it relates to non-small cell. If you had a huge amount of money, what would you do with it?
Oh. Almost stumped me there. I would... Well, can I give two options?
Sure.
Number one, I have a tremendous interest in the elderly, and I think they've been terribly neglected. So I would design a trial that specifically looks at the elderly. We've never answered the platinum question. It could be a very prosaic trial of single agent. We've actually proposed this to the Geriatric Oncology Consortium, looking at pemetrexed either alone or combined with carbo. For two reasons. Number one, the Europeans in particular feel that single agent is our standard in the elderly. I think most Americans, particularly if the patients are fit, will give them a platinum combination. But there's yet to be an elderly-specific trial that's really asked that question. My second reason for doing that is the elderly have been terribly underrepresented in clinical research, particularly those over 75 and 80, and I think that's a reasonable question to look at. We have tremendous interest in looking at bevacizumab and erlotinib in combination up front in the elderly as well. That has not been looked at. I think the other area that I'd really like to look at, and there's been a paucity of research here, in fact, hardly any leads, in locally advanced disease, if patients have done well, at least from the standpoint of the cancer, they are still dealing with a lot of morbidity, particularly pulmonary morbidity, and we've got to figure out a way to diminish the respiratory side effects of combined modality therapy. We've done a lousy job of that. So I would pour resources both into translational work and also into clinical agents that might help reverse pulmonary fibrosis.
What's the time course that you normally observe with that?
It'll first manifest typically about 6 weeks to 2 months out and may continue to manifest up to 6 months out. If it hasn't appeared within 6 months of completing chemoradiation, probably won't appear. But this is a big issue. I have so many patients who have successfully navigated a combined modality regimen for locally advanced disease, and they end up on steroids for radiation pneumonitis, or as my radiation oncology colleagues call it, combined modality pneumonitis. And many of these patients, tough to wean them off. It's a Pyrrhic victory if we've cured them and they're cushionoid on steroids and in and out of the hospital with respiratory insufficiency.
So if you had the means to study this, what kind of interventions would you look at?
There's got to be agents out there. We really need to collaborate with translational pulmonologists who have a tremendous interest in pulmonary fibrosis.
What about the actual radiation technique? How much do you think that might potentially
play
into it?
That's very important, but if you've got a huge tumor, I don't think focusing the field will necessarily eradicate this risk. Certainly 3D conformal will help reduce it. Gated radiation may help to reduce it, but it's still a major risk. And intriguingly, the RTOG is actually going to mount. It seems like a fairly prosaic trial, but I think it'll be important. Conventional dose RT given by whatever means, usually still 3D planning, versus a 3D conformal radiation to a somewhat higher dose, about 74 or 76 gray. So maybe a 20% increase in dose, but using more modern technique, giving a bigger dose, maybe that'll translate into a local control advantage that'll in turn translate into a survival advantage. There are a number of radiation questions that have just not been answered. The Chinese this year presented at ASCO a randomized trial looking at involved field nodal radiation versus elective nodal radiation. Very basic question. The group that got involved field that didn't have a broad nodal portal did better. They had fewer recurrences and less toxicity. So a very basic question that really could be done anywhere in this country, which we've neglected to do, I think has been at least partly addressed by our friends across the Pacific.